You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this segment is Laura Lewis. Laura, it's good to have you here.
Thanks very much, Eric. It's good to be here.
So, Laura, the way we begin the show, and with three candidates up for election for the 5th Ward spot, we're asking you all the same questions. So who are you? This is the standard opening question. Who are you? What do we need to know to have a balanced picture of you as a person?
Well, I am someone who's lived in Ithaca for more than 30 years. As I think about who I am, what comes to mind is I'm a community member. I am a mom. I am someone who has worked throughout my life. Really, since I was 16 years old, I've worked. I'm a wife. I am a sister. I have a younger brother and a younger sister who don't live in this area, but with whom I'm very close. We stay in touch quite a bit, even though we're very different politically and in so many ways. The differences are overcome by us growing up together. And when you ask who I am, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, a single mom. And our family had hard economic times, and that has really helped to shape who I am.
That's, you just gave us the web of relationships, and the initiating context. How has that poverty that? And those tight relationships shape the way you view, the way you experience the world.
Well, I experience the world in the sense that I'm keenly aware there are people who have far less than I am fortunate to have. There are people who have far more than I have. Growing up in a single-parent household, we didn't own a home. We lived in various apartments, and sometimes we had good landlords, and sometimes we did not. But my mother was always very generous. So, for example, we lived at one time in a house and there were some college students living next door to us. We didn't have much money. We didn't have much food. But my mother would invite students over for Thanksgiving dinner. So she believed in sharing what we had. And that really is one of the things that is at the root of my belief in community, my belief in sharing what I have, and in community service. I really took that lesson without even understanding it at the time. It wasn't until many years later.
Right, right. And you haven't said this, but what I see in your telling is it's a stance of being generous regardless of what you have.
Absolutely.
And that's even, the accent is on the generosity even more than the service in terms of the way you told that story.
Yes, it translated to, or transferred, I guess I should say, into many things that I've chosen to be involved in my life. When I was first in college, for example, there was an activity that I immediately gravitated to, and it was called Scarborough Fair. And it was a fair for kids who didn't often have an opportunity to go to events, who didn't have much money.
Right.
And we
couldn't afford to go to concerts.
And that was great to see kids enjoying themselves and not having to be aware of what they may have, what other kids around them had that they did not have. A sense of community, sharing, generosity is something that I've carried throughout my life.
And so that fits clearly in this segment of who are you? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you also brought some music with you. So what should we open with?
Well, I think it would be nice to open with one of Tenzin Çöpek's songs. Tenzin is a friend and a neighbor, and I just love his music. It speaks to me on so many levels. He's a brilliant musician, but he has a way of connecting people through his music. And so the song that I chose is Stay Close to Me from his Rockwood Ferry album, Speak Like Water.
Okay, here we go. Listening to WRFI Watkins Glen Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this segment is Laura Lewis. So, Laura, looking back on your life, what experiences, and pick one or two or few, have most defined or shaped the life you value living today? We got into that a little bit about the gratitude piece and about your serving and relating to others, but what are the things that have kind of made you take note, you know, and you look back on your life?
Well, what immediately comes to mind is having the opportunity to go to college. Neither of my parents graduated from high school, so it was a whole new world to me and to my mother. My father was not in the picture. And there were people who helped me, and I'm very keenly aware of the fact that I am where I am today because of so many people in my life. So I'm tying it yet back to that sense of gratitude, but it truly is the case that I would not have been able to go to college without the Educational Opportunity Program.
Right. And you're going to find that I talk with my hands, and they can't see it out there on the radio land, but you, I see you reacting to it. But please don't react to it. It's just part of my chatter. What I want to know, though, is that how did you learn to let other people help you? You know, how did you become aware that this is possible? How did you manage the sense of both empowerment and dependency that comes with help? How did you navigate that?
That's a really good question. I'm the oldest kid in my family, and there were times that I had to really take a role of being the responsible person in my family, let me say. And so I grew up kind of being a fighter and knowing when to step forward. But I also saw that there were people who were very ready to step in and help. So I think one of my strengths is knowing when to step forward and when to step back, knowing how to lead and how to be active and engaged as a team member or a community member.
What were the kinds of things you had to step forward for in your family or in your early life?
Well, getting a job and contributing financially is the most concrete example.
Yes. How old were you when you started doing that?
Actually, I said earlier that I was 16, but in fact, I was 15.
Probably much earlier.
Yeah, I was 15 when I was working at a local restaurant in Buffalo. And this was interesting because a number of my friends and I worked at this restaurant. And the owner of the restaurant knew that we did not at the time have working papers because we weren't 16. And
you needed papers at 16 in New York?
Yeah. And I think because
we needed them at 12 and I was working at 11. But interesting.
That was used as a controlling factor.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we complained about something not working in this little dive of a restaurant, the owner would conveniently remind us to bring in our papers.
Yeah.
And that squelched our concerns or complaints. So that sense of control and inequity and unfairness and yet the need for financial contributions in my family, all of that was at play.
And this is an interesting thing that we share. I started working at 11, which was a year below the legal age in Missouri, but they paid me 75 cents instead of 99 cents an hour, which was the minimum wage at the time. And as a consequence, somebody found that out and somebody in the community reported them. And they had to pay the back taxes and the back wages. But I never raised my voice. It's just that that's how people were looking. This is slightly more intact community where people kind of kept an eye on that kind of thing. So I didn't know that I wasn't alone.
This was a larger community.
I didn't know that I wasn't alone, though, but that proved it to me.
Yeah. The community I grew up in is more urban.
Yeah.
So people were not necessarily
They
weren't watching. My friends and I were watching.
Yes. And you will look out after each other, even though you can't take down the boss.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's that. Mm-hmm. But then I've also stepped forward. My younger brother, was not able to get certain services through BOCES. Mm-hmm. And so at the time, I rode my bike to BOCES, and I went in and I complained. And I said that we were taxpayers and that my brother had every right for the particular service he was seeking. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the times at a young age, I was probably 17 at that point, that I realized that speaking up can make a difference, and advocating for someone else, in this case, obviously, it was my brother. Mm-hmm. But speaking up is hard to do, but can make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Let me just... Have you... One of the things is, when you speak up, have you... What I was thinking when you first raised the example was there's speaking up, and then there's looking around to see if other people are either responding or if there are other people who are going to step up. Because when you're taking on that advocacy role at a very young age, you can be left hung out to dry. So how did you learn to scan or to acknowledge or to call on those allies who might help?
I am pretty good, I like to think, about connecting with people, mm-hmm. talking with people, sharing stories, my own story, my personal story. I'm a pretty open, transparent mm-hmm. person. And I think people respond to that, respect that. I ask for advice. I'm comfortable saying what I do not know. So that is all of a piece in terms of working effectively with other people or reaching out when you need something.
Right, right. But it also means that you trust the process.
Most of the time.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, because trust isn't something that others around us earn. It's something we give them. Mm-hmm. And so when you say most of the time, where's the part of the gear that doesn't quite work?
Well, I have a healthy suspicion, but I am fundamentally an optimist.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I want to see the best in people, just as I want to see the best in myself and the mm-hmm. people I love and the people I'm closest to. How do I work within a situation where there may be a challenge mm-hmm. or there may be a concern or I don't trust immediately? Well, I try to figure out where other people are coming from too.
Right. I guess, but trust isn't being able to turn off suspicion. It's being able to know what's in the environment around you, because some people are going to explode. Some people are going to have another value, and you can trust them because you know more or less what they're going to do. It's just a matter of when. And the trust is being as knowing that you have the skill to respond, not necessarily how it'll work out.
Mm-hmm.
Our trust isn't in outcomes mm-hmm. as much as it is in the process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I hear you kind of saying that, but it forces a level of this conversation that often doesn't get taken around the issue of trust. Because it's not that they're not going to hurt you. They are going to hurt you, but you're going to be prepared as part of the process.
Well, you said something that resonates with me, and that is I am a process-oriented person. Outcomes are important, mm-hmm. but the process we engage in is equally important.
Yeah. Cool. When in life did you come to that clarity about this balance? The outcomes are important, but the process is even slightly more important.
I think that was probably connected to when I decided to take that step, which was scary for me, to go to college. I'm talking about institution now, but
yeah.
I had to in some way trust that there could be a different life for me
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and for my family. I knew that I would be able to help even more financially with my family if I took that step, that risk, and trusted in the possibility of an education.
Right, right.
So it's not person-specific, but thinking about that institution,
well, no,
higher education.
And the thing is it's a generalizable skill. And we need to read people in the same way as we read institutions, and a lot of people's behavior are determined by their assumptions about the institutions that they're accountable to, or the organizations or families or whatever. So they're very, very much intertwined. But it sounds like you launched that you were coming from difficulty, but you launched in a position of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I launched where one out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20. The leaders of the school were fired because some kids had been caught with alcohol, but they didn't realize that there were kids in the community and adults selling the alcohol that was leading to some of these driving deaths and accidents. And there were also, and I blew the whistle on it. And I nearly got run off the road in the middle of the night because of that. So when I left, I fled. And that's a different sort of way of trying to move to the future, because you're kind of, there's no past to go back to safely. So, but it's so the trust issue for me has always been a little more dicey, but it's a very important issue the way you've raised it. Let's go to the next question. How have you changed? How have you changed in ways that you would not have anticipated or chosen without a push from life?
I've changed, I think being a parent has helped me to change. It has helped me at times to be more patient.
And why?
I have two sons, and it's taught me to see things through some different eyes.
What are those eyes? What were the eyes before, and what were the eyes after? What do you see now that you did not see before becoming a parent and going through that process of birthing and sending off these critters that kind of need you so damn much? And then they don't need you, and you don't want them to need you, but you don't want them to forget you.
Having children for me was distinctly saying that I am hopeful in the future, despite what is going on around me politically, economically. For me, having children meant that there can be change. They may be part of that change. But I wanted to make that statement by bringing these people into the world. That was kind of a part, and has always been a part of my professional work. I've been involved in student services, but that's working with people, obviously, who are not my children.
Right.
But when you have your own kids, seeing the challenges of raising a family, again, economically, trying to work out daycare. I see this in young families around me all the time now. I felt a sense of promise, a sense of hope that was very central to me through being a parent. That belief, that depth of love is just something that is hard to describe. Obviously, right. I'm having a hard time describing it.
And this may be because we kind of veered a little bit from the question, but it may be, but I want to explore just a little bit here. When you decided to have kids, was that hope clear, or did that become clear as you saw them emerge, literally to be born and to emerge as human beings in front of your face?
I think I had to take that step of hope in deciding to have children.
Right.
It was a very deliberate and conscious choice. I knew there would be struggles, but the struggles that I would face as a parent would be different than the struggles my mother had faced as a parent. Yeah. And very different from the struggles I had faced as the oldest sibling. But again, that hope in the future was fundamental.
And how did it, because there is a similarity in our roots in poverty, but our kids are not. So how did that affect your kind of experience of hope, and how to be a parent to kids who won't know experientially what it means to have to put food on the table for your family as a child, you know?
Yeah. Well, my experience is very different from my mother's experience. My kids' experience is very different mm-hmm. from mine. My kids were not growing up worried about mm-hmm. food on the table. They had their own worries. They had their own concerns. And I think in families, that is the case.
What I'm trying to get at here is, though, there is a way in which alliances and collaboration emerges in poor families that are functional, that doesn't have to emerge in more affluent families. And for me, a lot of my experience of hope is this tactile experience of hope is this ability to identify people, what people perceive they need to thrive, and helping them try to get it, or watching them and encouraging them when it's something that they can actually do on their own and need to do on their own. Mm-hmm. That puts me in a very different role that puts me in a similar role, but a very different context with my kids, who start with a lot more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've had very different lives and very different challenges to face. But it means that I have to be with them in a different way. You said mm-hmm. that you're being a parent, it changed you. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get at what the change is.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to put into words. I find it really difficult mm-hmm. to put into words, other than to come back to that sense of belief in the future. Hope for the future. Mm-hmm. I see my oldest son now has a child, and I see that as a very hopeful sign.
Right,
I see it as moving us into the future and hoping for a better future, especially, I don't want to mm-hmm. diverge into national politics, but it can be overwhelming. It can be distressing. And for me, coming back to the core of my sense of hope is in family and is in my local community and the things that mm-hmm. I can have some impact.
Right. And I don't know whether you made this switch or whether I introduced it, but you started out with optimism, realistic optimism. And the language has switched now to hope. And optimism is a bet on how things can work out. But hope is a stance. Hope is a stance that it's worth living in this way, because we can't necessarily control the outcome or even predict it, but this is the way we're going to work. And one of the definitions of faith is called realistic. Realism and hope is realistic hope, so that you never lose the stance, but you're always clear, in very much the same way with trust. Another definition mm-hmm. of faith is hope and trust, mm-hmm. the traditional mm-hmm. definition. And that's what I'm hearing you talk about here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the fact that I have always been an optimist mm-hmm. in the face of some real challenges, some things that I could have made far different decisions that would have meant a different life for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm very well aware that it would have meant a different life for the family I may have had.
Right. Yeah. Neat. Where should we go next musically?
Well, one of the other tunes I selected is March Up Fifth. Eileen Ivers is a wonderful musician. She plays this amazing blue violin. And I like this song because it speaks to me about suffrage movement and the reality that women have only had the right to vote for the last 100 years.
Here we go. Thank you. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And on this segment of the Made of Clay Report, our guest is Laura Lewis. So, Laura, for this segment, the question is, tell me about a time when your better judgment proved wrong and it hurt others. You know, what did you do in response to those who were hurt and by that failure? And how would others describe your response? Not an easy question.
Not an easy question, no. And that's one of the reasons I really appreciate you sending the questions in advance. Yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot. And this is a slightly different take, perhaps, on this question. But a decision I made that hurt others, hurt someone, was, in fact, my decision to go to college and move from my family's home. I was taking away financial resources. Mm-hmm. I was leaving my brother and my sister in a situation that I wouldn't be there to help with.
Right.
So in that respect, I wasn't overtly hurting others, but I was making a decision that I thought would, in the long run, benefit all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the situation that comes to my mind.
Right, and it's not a judgment that proved wrong, but no. It did hurt others.
Yes,
and you know this. Our stories are similar in yet other ways. My older brother, after our dad died, he was almost 16 when dad died, and then he graduated from high school. My dad was the kind of guy who the more affluent families would send their sons to him to help figure out who they were. He was a scoutmaster and a youth leader in our congregation, and he could take troubled kids and kind of calm them down and walk through things and help them make a next step in life. And when he died, it left kind of a hole in the community, because even though we were poor, mostly because there were too many kids, we raised all of our food and did the very subsistence farm stuff that people did of that life. We looked like back to earth people of 10 years later in the 60s, but we were really just poor. And when my brother was left, and my four sisters had all gone on to college and gone on to their lives, and two of them were out at that point, when my older brother left, he made a decision that he wasn't going to try, or actually when our dad died, he made the decision then that he wasn't going to try to be our dad, and he was going to get out. And that was the best thing that he could do. And he ended up with a scholarship to Harvard and an appointment to the Air Force Academy, because the respect that was held for my father and translated to him because of his performance got him out.
Mm-hmm.
In 69, he wasn't going to the Air Force Academy to get shot down over Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to go to Harvard, which he did. And he sent back his Social Security. We got Social Security survivor's benefits because the members of the congregation paid the taxes that my dad didn't pay, because he didn't have money to pay from 1960 to 66, when farmers were finally required to pay.
Mm.
But the congregation did. My brother sent that money back the whole time he was a student, so that it would be $25 a month more that we would have to live on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working. I never sent mine back, but he made the decision that he couldn't be our father, because he couldn't fill that void in our mother's life. So he moved on. It was very hard for me to accept, because I wanted him to be in that role, but it was a powerful decision that he needed to make. And it sounds like you made a similar sort of decision.
Yeah. And in the same way your brother was helping by sending money back to the community, I was doing that while I was in college, and then when I had subsequent jobs later, much later, after my mother's death, my brother and my sister have benefited from whatever financial support I've been able to offer, and certainly been able to help my kids in ways that weren't possible for my mother to be able to help me or my brother or my sister.
Right. And you're like, and in that sense, you are functioning like an immigrant and sending home remittances.
Which is exactly the description of my husband's family. Brothers came from Ireland oldest brother worked in the construction industry in New York City to send money back to Ireland to bring his next brother, my husband's father, over. So it that is very much an immigrant story.
Yeah. Right. So,
and a sense, too, of kind of strangers in a different world, strangers in a different land. There's a faculty member, there was a faculty member at Ithaca College, Jake Ryan, who came out of a working class background.
I know Jake. I knew Jake. We were on the Community Foundation board together.
And, okay, and, so you know of his
and
work.
Allies, yeah, yeah.
And that description of being a faculty member, being a stranger in this world, and that was very much my experience going to college and not having the background of anyone in my family who could understand, and not having anyone in the college I was attending have the same experience, the shared lived experience that I was bringing. So there was a period of time where I was kind of at a loss and trying to define who I was, who I wanted to be, not negating or denying where I came from, but at the same time not wanting to be where I came from.
Right, but also not knowing where you were.
Right, not knowing where I was and where I might be able to go in the future.
Right, so I want to. That hit me when I began to fail out of all my courses, the beginning of junior year, and I was just not functioning. It didn't make sense. I didn't know career options. I didn't know whatever, and so I took a leave of absence halfway through the semester rather than suffer this humiliation. But I was not going back. I spent the remaining 9 months of that contract in the apartment watching my peers do what I could not do. And I was going to learn how. I worked construction. I worked as a laborer, day laborer in construction here in Ithaca. And I watched my very affluent peers cope with what I had no clue about how to cope with. And I began to relax a little bit and began to sense how to be a human being in a place where it was all alien to me.
So you took a leave from Cornell and then you returned to your studies at Cornell.
Yes, 9 months later.
For me, I had a different experience. Yeah. I started college and decided to be an English major because I was reading things that my inner city high school had
not presented
me with. Yeah, yeah. That was more about controlling the high school population. And then I had some concerns about where I wanted to take that education. So I, too, took time away from school. I decided to take a leave of absence. The funds that were going toward my education were extremely limited and were available to me thanks to a program that grew out of the late 60s, and that is the Educational Opportunity Program. I was very aware of not wanting to squander the funds, the opportunity that was given to me. So I decided to take a leave of absence and really think about what I wanted, what direction, what path I wanted to be on. And during that leave of absence, I also did not go back home. That wasn't really an option. I was living in Binghamton at the time and worked at a department store. And spent that year reflecting on what I had been involved in. And I had this kind of epiphany. I was involved in a number of volunteer experiences. I worked in an admissions group where we would help students who were coming to visit the campus think about going to school. I had been counseling young women on reproductive rights. I was involved in a lot of student peer advising and counseling. And then it dawned on me that I could develop this into a career path. And that's exactly what I did. I went back to school. It took me an additional year because I changed majors. And then I went to graduate school in counseling program at SUNY Albany that had a particular emphasis on working with college-age students. Mm-hmm. I was so, I'm coming back to the similar theme, but I was so grateful for the people who had helped me see opportunities and not limitations. And I wanted to work in a field that might allow me to do the same mm-hmm. for other students.
Right.
And that's what I've done for many, many years.
Right, right, right. And it was a transition into a viable career.
Yes.
Because that was a growing demand for those roles in, since the 80s and early 90s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My choice to do holistic community development, I could have gone to medical school, I could have gone to law school. I went to seminary instead because given my class backgrounds and rural roots, I thought that was the best way to have access to all dimensions of people's lives. And for me to work, I needed that kind of access, which is what you have mm-hmm. in a community,
mm-hmm.
because that's the way communities, real communities, function. But I hadn't realized how our society had so far denigrated religion, mm. and that was not, if I had been a person of color or an immigrant, then that religious association would have had more weight. But being a white man and appearing to be privileged was a very different story.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to sort through some of that stuff has been a major piece of my life. I want to go back, though, to something you said earlier. It had your choice to go to college had a strong impact on your family that may have been negative. What was their reaction to your, other than bewilderment?
Mm-hmm.
How did they experience it as pain mm-hmm. in your eyes?
Well, it was pain, and I think it was fear,
mm-hmm.
and it was their sense that almost they had lost me.
Mm-hmm.
That it was a long time before my mother would write me letters, because she was aware of the fact that I was getting an education, and somehow I think she had a sense that I would view anything she wrote to me as something to be scrutinized.
Inadequate.
Yes.
Short.
Yes. I wasn't going to be correcting her letters and sending them back to her. I just wanted that...
Love.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't necessarily feel that I needed approval,
right?
Because I was beyond that. I had moved into a different world,
and also as an independent advocate, and you that's not the issue,
right?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. So I kept very close relationship though with my brother and my sister, and I had them come visit me at college. I wanted to expose them to mm-hmm. another world. Neither of them chose college. My brother, in fact, chose the Navy, and then chose after the Navy to become a police officer. So there's a sense that he too wanted to serve his community. We just took different paths in doing that.
And the military for working class America of any color or culture is the avenue.
Right.
And even for many new immigrants, it's a mm-hmm. it's a quick way mm-hmm. to serve. And we don't think about that. Let's take, I'm going to say, let's play one more piece of music and then go to the last set of questions. What should we play?
Okay. I would, I chose Sacred Island, a Taj Mahal piece. My older son lives with his wife and their young son in Honolulu, her hometown. And I saw Taj Mahal when he was here in Ithaca a few years ago. And this song just makes me think of Chris and Drusilla.
Right. And part of the consequences of your choices.
Yes.
To leave. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Laura Lewis. So, Laura, in the final segment of the show, we address the question, how do you take care of yourself? What do you do to restore yourself? How do you know you need to do it throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly?
That, too, is a really good question and one that not enough people consider or pay attention to, in my view. For myself, I have worked at Cornell in student services and for 10 years was one of the university crisis managers. And self-care is really important when mm-hmm. you're doing tough work, when you're doing any kind of work.
Right.
When you have a family, there are stresses in all of our lives. For me, connecting with family, friends, neighbors, getting together for cooking dinners together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I run with one of my neighbors just this weekend. We participated in the Cancer Resource Center's 5K run, mm-hmm. which was absolutely great. My sister is a cancer survivor, so I had her in my heart and my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Reading and quiet time is important to me and contributes to my self-care. I'm pretty good about knowing when I should take time for myself. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I always do it.
Okay. And so how do you know that you need to take a time out or to take a reset?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to you or the people around you?
I get grouchy and my husband says, why don't you go for a run? and this has happened more than once. I can't sleep well at night because I'm writing emails in my head.
I see.
Yeah. I know that the next day I need to tackle something and get it out of my head onto paper.
Right.
And I need to connect with people and talk with people about what's going on. So for me, self-care has a lot to do with connecting with others, has a lot to do with physical activity,
mm-hmm.
has a lot to do with being able to take a self-check
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, what's going on and why is it going on and what am I anxious about and why and how do I address it?
Right. When in your life did you come to realize that your self-care is your problem? As opposed to somebody else that could step in and take care of you.
Oh, real early.
Yeah. But in poverty, we often realize right. that's a challenge for us, but we often don't realize that it doesn't matter whether we're in poverty or not. It's our job anyway.
Yeah. For me, action and activity is important. It's a vital part of my life. And it's also maybe in an odd way that doesn't make sense to some, is related to self-care. I don't want to feel overwhelmed and disabled by choices that others are making mm-hmm. for me.
Right.
I want to be an active participant.
Right. I mean, I've been, part of my meditation lately has been on this notion of agency.
Mm.
When a person has a sense of agency, they can have no privilege whatsoever in the world, but have a tremendous impact on their life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of people who come out of backgrounds of minimal to no privilege have. We sometimes undermine them by looking at the privilege issues rather than supporting them in their agency.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you learn to cultivate your sense of agency, that there would be no rescue?
That's a tough question. And the only thing I can think of is, again, to say that activity, getting involved, mm-hmm. is the motivator for me.
Right.
So when you were asking the question, one of the things that came to my mind is one of the issues I'm most passionate about is affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier growing up in rental housing right. and having landlords that were good and not so good. I have been on the board of directors of Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Services mm-hmm. for about 18 years. I've been very active in that organization. It's wonderful that we're sitting here in this studio and Breckenridge Place is across right across the street. The street. Yep. And so in terms of agency and taking what I can into consideration and taking action has been really important for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, wanting to have an impact.
Yes.
On not only for yourself, but in a fair way for those around you, and minimizing the way in which their decisions harm you.
Yes.
I'm just trying to summarize a little bit of what I
Yeah, heard. But also realizing that some of the actions I take are for others, for mm-hmm. example, serving mm-hmm. on a board of directors, and yet I realize that it's improving my life too.
Right.
It's improving my community. Yeah. It's improving my neighborhood. It's improving the lives of families and the lives of those living in our community. I'm also aware that if, and this is going off perhaps in a slightly different direction, mm-hmm. but if we're able to offer more housing opportunities for people, then we're also addressing another important issue, and that is that of sustainability.
Right, right. And I want to tie the knot. Some work out of human ecology suggests that people need 7 different roles in their lives in order to maintain the sense of meaningful engagement and resilience that will allow them to live well for mm-hmm. for you know the long haul. And every role that we have is both for ourselves mm-hmm. and others. And that's just what you've said. So that's part of self-care. But in that context, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's just a logical thing to say. One of the unfortunate things we've had in terms of thinking about housing is Americans are consuming twice as much square footage per person for housing now than we did, say, 50 years ago. But if we would think about using our existing housing, the unused bedrooms, the unused spaces, allowing people to rethink physical spaces, we might not have to build as much to really adequately house those who can't afford to live here but might want to live here. The quarter, 20 to 30% of our workforce that has to commute in mm-hmm. from out of the county because they can't afford to live here. That there are many other ways to think about it that also involve relationships, which is one of your primary concerns. Mm-hmm. What I noticed in your telling of your story was your self-care is all physical activity or relational, and they combine around cooking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just kind of a really basic way of living. And what you didn't talk about was cultivating your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, my guess is that just happens in a way. But I want you to kind of address that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I didn't mention that another important way I take care of myself is that time to be alone and think and reading time.
Yep.
And not reading news, because that engages me in a different way, an important way.
Hmm.
But I have been in a book group for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's relational.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because we get together and we talk about books and we talk about our lives. But having that time to step away from everything else. And, you know, interesting, when I was growing up, I hadn't thought of this before right now, but one of the ways of dealing with my surroundings and what I was perceiving as my life as a kid was to go to the library and just escape into other worlds.
Right.
I would ride my bike to the library in Buffalo uh-huh. and just go in and consume massively. And I was at the library every week.
Right.
So that was early on self-care.
Right.
And it has, you know, continued through my adult life.
Right, right. And one of the things, and this is, I'm going to make an interpretation which may or may not fit you, but I want to make it in terms of this community. We are a highly intellectual community, but most of our lives are lived in emotional and visceral reactions, which are embodied in our relationships. When we put our intellectual activity in the context of our relationships, it grounds it in a way that if we don't, we just hammer each other in all sorts of negative ways, and we don't take responsibility for the emotions or the visceral reactions that we cause. And that's, I mean, that's my sermonette for this morning. But part of working, layering in the intellectual piece on the foundation of the relational piece is really important. We often don't talk about it.
And if I could just add, sure. I don't think I've mentioned this before, but my husband is a faculty member at Ithaca College in the English department. So he teaches American literature and Irish mm-hmm. literature, and we certainly have plenty of discussions around poetry and sure. Irish literature yeah. around our dinner table.
Yeah, cool, cool. Laura, it's been really wonderful to get to know you. What are we closing with here?
Thank you, Eric. I've really enjoyed this too. And I selected another Tenzin Chopak tune. This is Knock at the Door. I think this song is just, it's very, very moving for me and speaks to the need to open our communities, open our doors, and bring people in.
Here we go.
Who is that knocking? Come on in. Come on in now. Take your place. Take your place with the hungry. With the hungry, are your dinner is late. Your dinner is late. Yeah.